We're small, but we're this morning, so it's good to be able to get back up in front of you and bring another lesson. As I think Ken mentioned this morning, Craig and family are out of town. They're up in Danville. Ryan and Jennifer, Ryan's supported by the Danville group, so they went up there to be with them and have the day with them. And then I think he's also gone next week as well. So we'll have some different speakers, obviously, for the next couple of weeks. I think Al is actually preaching next Sunday, and that's our song service Sunday. And then I'm going to try it again tonight, so bear with me if you would. I want to ask a question this morning. I think it's a question we all have asked ourselves or need to ask ourselves, and one that I think is pretty important for each one of us. That question is, who do we trust, or who do you trust in particular? Just kind of think about that. Who in your life is dependable? Who is someone you know you can count on? 9/11/2012. I don't know if you remember anything about that date, but think about that for a moment. And also, a guy by the name of J. Christopher Stevens. Does anybody know who that is? Getting a lot of puzzled looks and head shakes. Well, last night, Julie and I sat down after being outside for what seemed like hours. As you know, it was pretty warm yesterday, and we did our outside chores because we had kind of pushed the yard back and so forth because of the weather, and it was pretty dry, but that got taken care of. But we sat down in front of the television, which we do quite often on Saturday evenings. But usually when I pick a show on television, it's not one Julie necessarily wants to watch. I don't know if that happens at your houses or not, but it does at ours. So I'm one of these people that likes to watch the action thrillers and those type of movies, and she's kind of the one that, I don't know that she gets into the love stories as much as she gets into, you know, things that are that have themes to it, to them, and thoughts to them. So I turn on a movie, it's called 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. So you think about the date and the name that I just gave you, and that's what relates to that particular movie. I think it was put out in 2016. And she actually stuck with me almost the time. It was kind of amazing. But that show is definitely not one you want to watch if you've got a weak stomach, because there was a lot of gruesome things that happened. And it was a true story, real to life, as we all know. And I think just by your reactions, and by, I'm sure, reactions of others, if I were to mention that date and that particular name, people kind of forgot about it. It was kind of pushed to the side. And they are actually still investigating that particular situation that happened in Benghazi back in 2012, you know, almost 6 years later, to see what really happened. And they should, I think. But that's not why I'm bringing this up. Some interesting points, though, to this whole situation. I think we all know that once Libya fell after Gaddafi was taken out of power, that the whole state was basically in chaos. And that's what caused this particular siege that happened. And it was interesting, too, in the movie, and I hadn't really thought about it. There, if you don't have a state per se, or a country per se, that has any authority and it's in chaos, then there's an ambassador there, which J. Christopher Stevens was. But what authority did he have? Because there was really no government involved. So here the poor guy is in Benghazi with what amounted to about three people to protect him in that particular compound, and the compound wasn't even secure. They were commenting on that right at the start of the movie. So he was in a predicament. And he should have figured that out, but I don't guess he really did until it was too late. Close to them in Tripoli, of course, Libya is mostly desert, so I think the two larger cities, Tripoli's within a half an hour drive at the most from Benghazi. But in Tripoli, there was a CIA compound set up, and there were 30 people there at that particular compound that were all working their jobs within the CIA in that particular state at that point in time. With them were six men who basically were soldiers. They would have been contracted. They were CIA people, but they were contracted to the CIA. And therefore, that's where they got the name. These six guys basically held off hundreds and hundreds of insurgents that attacked that compound after they had taken out the one in Benghazi and basically killed the ambassador. So, for 13 hours, these guys are up there getting attacked multiple times, and all of them, I think, from what I remember, but two survived the situation, and they were eventually rescued along with the other 30 Americans. But the point I wanted to make was in this movie, I saw it at least four or five times. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but in the time that it was on, four or five times, they would have people come up to them with guns, RPGs, whatever, face to face. They're pointing their guns at each other, and the CIA soldiers basically say, "Who are you?" They didn't know who they were. They didn't know if they were good guys, they were bad guys. They just didn't know. And that's kind of what it's come to, if you think about it, in the situations that we've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and other countries. You don't know who your friends are, and you don't know who your enemies are. And those insurgents took advantage of that, because they were inside of both of those, or in the fringes of both of those compounds many, many times, and they didn't know who friend or foe was. So think about that. In a situation of who do you trust, what kind of situation were they put in? In a physical realm, those guys could have put their guns down, and they could have just shot them right there, and they were done. That's kind of my thought this morning. And once again, that question, who do you trust? Who do you really trust? Well, I'm sure that if someone came up to you and asked you if you trusted Jesus Christ, that no one would fail that particular quiz. Each one of us would say, "Of course I do. There's no question I do." I think the question comes as well as, why do we trust him? In the book of John, which is where Ken read for us this morning, we saw a lady who eventually Christ gained her trust. We know that she had several obstacles, and we're not going to reread that particular section. That was kind of why I had Ken read it this morning. I didn't know how long my voice would go, so appreciate him doing that. But what do you know about the Samaritans? Well, I think we all know from our studies that the Samaritans were looked down upon by the Jews. So here's Jesus, he's a Jew, with her at the well. And what was in her mind? Can I trust this guy? Can I really trust him? Not only that, she was a woman, he was a man. And even in societies over there today, same thing goes. The men are looked up to. The women, basically, a lot of them cover their faces or stay in the background. He was a rabbi. Rabbis didn't normally talk to women. So once again, she's got all these things kind of pulling her to where she wasn't sure she could trust him. So when Jesus spoke to her, I'm sure she was a little bit surprised. And as I said, no doubt a little wary of the situation that was happening here. And she was going to hold back some information because of that. The other thing, well, as we saw in this passage, she had five husbands. So I'm sure there was a lot of trust issues because of that situation as well. So the neat thing about it is, as Jesus began to talk to her here, as we saw in this passage about the living water and what he had to offer her, she did what we should do when it comes to trusting an individual. She asked a lot of questions. She started asking questions right off. And I did that, and as would be the case with us when we're talking to someone and trying to learn if we can really trust that person, she figured out that there was something about him, something that was different about him. And after spending time with him, she found out this guy is trustworthy. He's faithful. He's dependable. He's one that's not telling me something that's not true. So perhaps the woman at the well is like you have been at times, a little bit cautious. Chances are, you know, if you'd had five spouses and they've let you down, that's going to happen. You've been betrayed so many times that you're going to really wonder who you can trust. You've been lied to, promises have been broken. People that you thought were always there for you, they weren't. They let you down. So who can you trust? And that's an important question that I hope we can pay a little heed to this morning. The writer of Hebrews tells us there is someone we can trust, and that is Jesus Christ. The theme of Hebrews chapter 3, in fact, is faithfulness. The writer is going to make that point that Jesus is faithful to us. So, of course, if he is faithful to us, we need to be faithful to him as well. All of us probably realize that a Christian who's growing and maturing as he ought to should have the quality of faithfulness in their life. Revelation 2 verse 10 proves how God feels about the faithfulness of Jesus. He said in that passage, be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. And so we stress the fact that once a person becomes a Christian, he has to remain a faithful one. But I think sometimes we need to think about that and really understand what is meant by the word faithful. I think we've all kind of come to equate faithfulness to worship service attendance. I'm not saying that being here is not important, not at all. But we sometimes consider someone that's a faithful Christian to be someone who attends worship service regularly. And an unfaithful member is someone who doesn't. Simple as that. We try to make it simple. But in limiting the concept of faithfulness in that one area, I think we really miss the point. Faithfulness is the quality that makes a person reliable, loyal, and dependable in the things that he or she says and does. And I think a better translation of the Greek word here in the book of Hebrews would be the word dependability or reliability. One aspect of the fruit of the Spirit that shows how well we are maturing and growing is that concept of dependability. So how reliable are you? How reliable am I? I think we all need to ask ourselves that question. How much can others count on you doing what you say you're going to do? How trustworthy are you? How likely are you to the commitments that you've made, even when it gets tough to do so at times, which it does? But before the Hebrew writer deals with the subject of how we ought to be faithful to God, he's going to talk a little bit about Christ and his faithfulness. So turn with me back to, I think I mentioned, the book of Hebrews, chapter 3. And let's look at the first six verses of that particular book, Hebrews 3, verses 1 through 6. It says, "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. So Hebrews here, and the writer of it, really is talking to the Jewish Christians of that day, the converts that had been converted to Christianity. So it shouldn't be odd to us that here in this passage he's comparing Christ to Moses, or Moses to Christ, vice versa. So why does he do that? Well, that's as simple as I just said, because Moses would have been right up there, probably close to Abraham, when it came to his standing with the Jews. But Christ, at this point in their lives, should have already passed both of them up when it comes to standing. You think about Moses, and he did what God asked him to do. He had some minor pitfalls, obviously, and people do, but for 40 years, he did what God used him to do with his people. He took the children, as we know, out of Egypt into Israel. He got them through the Red Sea situation, and he was faithful in the wilderness, even when things got difficult. Moses was faithful, but Jesus was more so. From the time he was a child, he was always about his father's business. We've talked about that in our Wednesday night studies in the last 2 or 3 months. In John 8:29, Jesus says, "I always do those things that please him." And in John 17:4, Jesus prays, "I have glorified you on earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do." So Jesus always did his father's will. He was faithful. And that faithfulness was most clearly demonstrated when he was willing and did go to the cross for the entirety of mankind, you and me as well. In that one act, Jesus was faithful to God and faithful to each one of us. Because of the cross, Jesus proved that he could be trusted. More specifically, it proves that each one of us can trust him as individuals. We can trust him when our lives are falling apart because he was willing to give that ultimate sacrifice to prove that trust that we should have in him. The book of Hebrews, as I alluded to earlier, is a book written to those Jewish converts. And I think it's important to note that at this point, times have become hard. The church was being persecuted, and many of them were giving up in those times. But this book was a book of encouragement. The author's saying, look, you have it so much better. Jesus now is your high priest. He's far superior to anyone or anything that you have ever had in your lives. He's better than the angels. He's better than Moses. He's more trustworthy than anything that any of you have ever experienced. And now, with that side note in mind, let's look at verse 6 here. And it starts, "But Christ, as a son over his own house, whose house we are." If you stop right there, I think the point the author of this book is making is that when you take a fresh look at Christ, you also get a renewed picture of yourself. Jesus is the Son of God over God's house. But what is this house? Well, the house is us. It's the church. It's not the building around us. It's the church. And we need to see ourselves for who we are. We are God's family. And when we really see Jesus for who he is, then we see ourselves for who we are. I think Ken, this morning in class, and I kind of threw out a very similar thought. If we see ourselves for who we are and we're emulating Jesus in our lives, then there should be no question what we're about. we should know ourselves and know what we're about. And I think that kind of applies to that thought there as well. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10 is another passage that I think kind of coincides with this particular line of thought. It says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." Peter says here, you're the people of God. Christians who are about to give up on the church, which was the case here in Hebrews, need to see themselves as God's people, the people of God. If we ever come to see ourselves as the family of God, then a lot of things, I think, would change. I don't believe we'd have to beg or shame people into attending the services of the church. We wouldn't have to worry about cliques, factions within the groups. I know we're small enough that that really doesn't happen anymore, but I've seen that in groups that I've been involved in. And I think all of us as well would be thrilled about being a part of the family of God, so thrilled that we would never exclude another from the work that that family is in. I don't think we would ever have trouble as well getting people to work for the Lord in the area of service. If you really see yourself as a part of the family of God, then your love for him would lead you to serve. There would be no question. You'd be right there, ready to go. You'd want to be involved. You wouldn't want to just sit in the pew for an hour or two each week and then go home and leave it at that. But let's come back to the subject of faithfulness. The Hebrew writer makes the point that since Jesus has been our faithful high priest, or has been faithful to us, then we ought to be faithful to him. Why? Because our goal is to be just like Jesus Christ. We're to emulate what he did as he walked this earth. And the more that we're like him, the more we're going to fulfill the purpose that God has for each one of us on this earth as well. Let's be honest. Dependability is a virtue that's become quite rare in the society that we live in today. You used to be able to count on people. You'd go somewhere and there'd be some type of business deal made, and all that took place was what? Simple handshake. And that's all it took. Now people are ready to sue this person for that thing or that person for this or whatever, and there's no semblance of people keeping their word anymore. They're all in it for themselves. I'm not totally sure why, other than what I just said, that is happening, but I do know that part of it has to do with the fact that people are getting farther and farther away from God, and that fits right in with the whole mix. The idea of making a commitment and sticking to it just doesn't seem to mean that much to people anymore. People will make a commitment as far as marriage, till death do us part, and then what happens? They have problems, they walk away from the situation. People can't hold jobs because of their inability to get to work. Trust me, I know. Or I've even had situations where I've called people in for an interview, set the time, set the day. They don't even show up for an interview. Why did they say they'd be there if they weren't planning on being there in the first place? In short, most people can't be depended upon, and that's sad. As I mentioned a moment ago, I think the other reason relates to selfishness, because when someone's living at a worldly level, he's not really looking out for anybody but himself. And so if he makes a promise to do something and finds something that he likes better, guess what? He's not going to take care of his obligations. He's going to do what he wants to do because it seems better for him. It's more into what he or she wants to do. But a Christian's movement toward maturity in Christ, I think, is largely measurable in terms of his progress toward just that. Being dependable. And I think that's the main point that I want you to get out of the lesson this morning. A Christian's movement toward maturity in Christ is largely measurable in terms of his progress toward dependability. Being more faithful, more reliable, more dependable is an evidence that one is becoming more and more like Jesus Christ. Faithfulness is demonstrated, I think, in a number of ways. It can be found in constant, generous giving, regular attendance at worship, teaching classes when there's a need, doing physical work around the building or preparing food for those members who might be in need, or just being there for someone when they need to have someone to talk to. It's resisting the temptation to jump into a greener pasture when you made a commitment to stay in this pasture, whether it's marriage, whether it's church obligations, a business deal, or a job assignment. It's as simple as that. It seems really simple, but people don't make things simple. For different Christians, faithfulness may involve different things. It may involve continuing to teach a Bible class when it doesn't seem like really other people are appreciating the sacrifice that you're making in doing so. You just have to keep going. It may involve staying with difficult tasks, paying bills, completing assignments, keeping appointments, honoring your commitments, I think would be the summary of all of that. But it's important that we just hang in there, that we just keep doing it. And if we hang in there, then the writer gives us this admonition. He tells us in chapter 3, verse 14 of the book of Hebrews, kind of one of my favorite passages. I'm looking at the right one here. Yeah. It says, "For we have become partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end." If we remain confident, we remain faithful, guess what? God is faithful to us. And he's going to give us exactly what he says here. He's going to give us a good end, an eternal end. But it's up to us to do that, to remain faithful, just as his son, Jesus Christ, was faithful to him and was faithful to us. So this morning, think about it. Are you trustworthy? Can you be trusted? Jesus has already proved his dependability by dying on the cross for each one of us. And our goal each day should be to be faithful each day, just as Jesus was, to be more and more like him. So let the word guide your life and let God change you to be what he wants you to be. This morning, if there's any here that have a need of our congregation here, I think all of us have been baptized here, but if you have a need of the congregation as far as prayers or as far as listening and trying to help and going to God in prayer for you, we're all here for one another. And we offer an invitation, as we know, each time we come together. So we'll offer that invitation at this time as we stand, as we sing.